Welcome back to this week's Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine. And Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist, has several additional questions for us to answer. So,
yes.
Mm-hmm. What are those questions?
This is from Janice in Connecticut. She says, I have been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and I'm 58. She would like to know, Dr. Hoffman, what do you think about cod liver oil? And what about fermented cod liver oil? Is it better to take fermented? Dr. Terry Walls recommends it in her book, The Walls Protocol for MS. Can it be taken in place of fish oil or vitamin D? Thank you for all that you do.
This is actually the first time that I've heard of fermented cod liver oil.
Yeah.
And I'm familiar with the Walls Protocol because we did interview Dr. Walls. For our listening audience who are not familiar with Dr. Terry Walls, she is a physician who herself was afflicted with multiple sclerosis, but a very serious progressive form of multiple sclerosis, and she was placed on medications. And she was very conventional at the time. She said, fine, you know, let's, you know, sir. She clicked her heels and said, okay, I'll take whatever you want to give me. But she realized that she wasn't getting better. She was deteriorating progressively, and she was feeling kind of desperate, and she was headed for a wheelchair or worse. And she began to access natural approaches in researching diet. And she has devised an approach which is based on the paleo diet, her version of the paleo diet, that is rich in ancestral foods. She avoids grains and dairy. And she uses lots of omega-3 fatty acids. But I didn't realize that she had a particular, that she was particularly enamored of not just cod liver oil, but fermented cod liver oil. Do you have any idea what the benefits of a fermented cod liver oil might be?
Fermented, I think the benefit, if any, may be that it's not used under a high heat process to extract the oil from the fish. Now, that's a question mark, and maybe because fermentation has been done for thousands of years, maybe there is that angle of it. But really what jumps out at me here is cod liver oil at all. Because cod liver oil, my concern with it is it has a very high amount of vitamin A, which over a long period of time can be damaging to the liver. So I'm not a huge proponent of cod liver oil, not for long periods of time. And cod liver oil today has much more vitamin A and much less vitamin D than it did, say, what, 60 years ago?
Exactly,
Dr.
yeah.
Hoffman?
It was actually, I mean, you're talking to my grandparents, they used to give them a really stinky-tasting cod liver oil in, you know, around the years, so the early 1900s. And this is actually what helped prevent malnutrition during times of deprivation in a lot of the kids in those parts of the world where they didn't get a lot of sun. Their only source of vitamin D was the cod liver oil, and they got some omega-3 fatty acids, and they got some vitamin A to stimulate their immune system. But for some reason, the composition of these fish oils has changed where it's now more vitamin A than vitamin D. And there's some thought that vitamin A may interfere with the absorption of vitamin D. And there's some concern that high doses of vitamin A may increase the risk of osteoporosis even. Plus, the EPA DHA concentration in cod liver oil is far less than it is in ordinary fish oil. I mean, in fish oil that is in capsules that's molecularly distilled very concentrated. So I'm not sure why she recommends that. I mean, you would have to ask her.
So
then the question is, does that help Parkinson's? Well, Parkinson's, in my opinion, is a little different. I think that dietary measures can be helpful in Parkinson's. I think what Dr. Walls is discovering is that she's put out a diet for MS, and people with other brain disorders are trying it, and they think it's helpful. And her approach is not too different from ours, because we put patients on paleo-type diets often for this, and we eliminate food allergens. We do subscribe to the grain-brain hypothesis, which is that some people have problems in relationship to gluten or excess sugars and carbohydrates that does affect the brain. And so that type of diet can be beneficial. You know, there's a new finding that cinnamon may be beneficial for Parkinson's disease. That's the latest.
Wow.
Yeah, that's in Science Daily this week. And that's a story I'm going to cover
this
weekend.
I still think the superstar antioxidant is probably still glutathione, though.
Absolutely.
We get remarkable results with glutathione. That and CoQ10.
Needs to be given intravenously. That's the challenge for patients, is to get to the office frequently enough to get their intravenous treatments, because I think glutathione given orally is not that valuable. And then the high-dose CoQ10.
CoQ10 taken orally and glutathione via IV is wonderful. And, you know, Parkinson's is also said to be helped by some detox methods, but you do it under supervision. You don't do it on your own. You know, people are always, we're always asking people, well, do you live near a farm? Do you live in a very urban area? Places where there are lots of toxins, that could be a component in what may be the instigator in promoting.
We have a patient who has, right now, and you're familiar with her, she comes in and gets her glutathione infusions. And when we tested her, she actually has celiac disease. She actually has not just a slight gluten antibodies or a little mild wheat allergy, but she has the transglutaminase antibodies that are a hallmark of celiac disease. And she's definitely got grain brain. And, you know, we've also seen patients who have vitamin B12 issues. We see patients who have, you know, various types of heavy metal exposure. We had a patient who came in who had a Parkinson's-like syndrome. She couldn't walk. And, you know, I asked if she ever lived on a farm or was exposed to chemicals, and she said no. And, you know, we were well into the visit. You know, it was like an hour and 15 minutes into the visit. And I looked down at her papers that her husband had filled out, because she couldn't barely write. And her address was 15 Golf Lane. And I looked up and I said, do you happen by any chance to live on or near a golf course? And the husband very proudly said, yes, we've looked forward to retiring for so many years. And finally, we've got this beautiful house right on the green. I can just walk. I can open the screen door. I can walk right out onto the green. And I said, well, do you realize how many chemicals they have to pour on a golf course to maintain
to make it look like green carpet? Yeah,
to make it look like AstroTurf. And, you know, day in and day out, they're being exposed to that. And it's, oh, my goodness. You know, it's like those are supposed to be the golden years, and now you're in a chemical soup.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Hopefully that helps you, Janice.
Yep.
Okay. Now, we have one from Bob. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I have heard that drinking water or any fluid while eating will dilute the enzymes that break down food. Is there any truth to this? This is always a question that I get a lot from our patients. Yeah,
and the origins of this are in the actually it goes back to the time when I was practicing macrobiotics.
And you probably had the rule to just drink in between meals and not during.
Right, and you know, so you were supposed to drink in between, and you were supposed to not dilute the nutrients or your digestive juice.
So that could be something. All right. I do get this question a lot, and I tell people, you know, drink when you're thirsty, no matter when that is. However, it could be better or, you know, in your favor just to have fluid in between meals. I would prefer that you don't fill up on a whole lot of fluid and then go eat your meal, and you're not going to be able to eat enough food because you just drank so much water and now you're feeling somewhat waterlogged. That's not helpful either.
Right.
However, because so many of us take our supplements during a meal, and if you could swallow a handful like I can with very little water, that took some years to achieve, by the way. That didn't happen overnight.
It's an art.
You get to do it. You get to finally say, this is fine, and just take the handful with the little water and continue eating. Mm-hmm. That's really the best way I find to take supplements. But
I really, I really don't think that there's any truth to this. And, you know, one of the ways that we can ascertain the truth or lack thereof is if you watch the way that animals eat. And, you know, whenever I gave my dog, you know, my dearly beloved childhood dog, I don't have a dog now, but I remember my childhood dog, his bowl of dog food, it was always a double bowl. There was a water bowl, and then there was the dog food bowl. And so he would just bolt the food down, but then he would pause, and then he'd slurp some water because you know he realized that you know that stuff was just going to get stuck in his craw if he didn't have some water to lubricate it to make it go down. So You know, I think in nature, there, you know, animals often avail themselves of water supplies to help them eat.
Well, you know what? That also makes a great case. You know, if this were true, let's say this were true, that we shouldn't have any fluid while we eat.
Yeah.
Well, what about soups and stews?
Yeah, exactly.
What do we do with the broth?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's not going to work either. So yeah. I agree.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, if you overload yourself or waterlog yourself, there's a chance that you could have a problem. But you know,
Drink gallons of water to get any kind of hyponatremia. But for people, for instance, who are trying to lose some pounds, mm-hmm. a good bit of advice is to drink a full glass of water before you sit down for your meal. That's true,
yep.
And it's particularly true in the circumstances of sometimes it feels like hunger, but it's actually thirst.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in hot weather. So I will advise some of my clients who are trying to lose weight, you know, next time you feel like you're hungry or you're not sure if you're hungry, maybe you feel like you're bored or something, go drink a glass of cold water and see if that doesn't sate you.
And here's
if you're hungry or not.
Another tip. If, you know, especially in the summer, it's like a really hot summer day and, you know, you're coming back, you've been, you know, stuck on the subway and, it's, you know, so you're sweating and you're just visualizing, or maybe you're driving on the Long Island Expressway and you're turning into your driveway and you're just visualizing that nice cold can of beer or bottle of beer. That's the first thing you're going to do. You're going to loosen your tie, you're going to get in there, open the kitchen door, and you're just going to like open up a cold one. Before you do that, you know, look, I mean, it's okay to have beer and alcohol, but if you want to minimize your alcohol intake, before you have your alcoholic beverage, just have like a spritzer of seltzer with ice and a little bit of juice, and just drink a glass or two of that, sate your thirst.
Yeah.
And then if you want to get a little, you know, get a little buzz, you can have a beer or you can have a little cocktail. But lest you drink, you know, lest you think you're hydrating yourself with beer and alcohol, that's not the case. You'll ultimately, it's a dehydrator ultimately.
Ultimately, that's right. So alcohol, a nice cold beer, especially if you've been, you know, tarring and shingling a roof or something like that, is not
right.
The way to go.
Exactly.
First of all, you're terribly dehydrated.
And don't bring a six-pack onto the roof with you.
Don't do
which
that
I hired those roofers a couple of years ago. I'm never going to hire them again.
And by doggone it, that beer got warm.
Wait a minute. Your husband's a contractor. Paul doesn't do that when he does
no,
roofing
he,
jobs.
He will shingle a roof, but he's not going to have a beer. At least not until he comes off the roof anyway.
Okay.
But no, it's good to remind people who want that. Sometimes that cold beer on a hot day and you're already sweating and all this other stuff,
yeah
it could taste good, but watch out.
Yeah.
You really want to take care of your thirst first and then enjoy the beer.
Exactly.
You're absolutely right.
I try to discipline myself because, you know, a cocktail is not necessarily a thirst quencher. It's just another purpose to it. Okay. Let's move on. What else we got?
Okay. We've got one from... Okay, I don't have a name here. Dr. Hoffman, could you recommend a book that incorporates both naturopathic medicine and conventional medicine for specific disease conditions? Thanks. Love the Intelligent Medicine podcast. Keep it up.
Well, there are quite a few of those.
Yeah.
And, you know, to be self-serving, I've written several books myself. You know, check them out at drhoffman.com. But I haven't written a comprehensive encyclopedic book about everything. There's one that both of us like, but it's pretty academic, and it's, you know, when you talk about something being a doorstop, this book is a doorstop. It's really a big, heavy tome, and it's the culmination of 20 or 30 years of research by my good colleague, Dr. Alan Gaby, and it's called Nutritional Medicine, and it's a fabulous, just encyclopedic recitation of all these various diseases and nutritional ideas.
I am constantly borrowing that book from your office.
But you know what's interesting about...
If it's never not in your office, you know it's on my desk.
But you know what's interesting about that? The book is very comprehensive, but because the field is so encyclopedic and huge, I don't even think it covers every conceivable choice, because in order for it to do that, they would have to be, you know, 50 volumes. So he's managed to, in a relatively concise way, summarize some of the more plausible ways to treat various things. There's another book. It's called Natural Medicine, and it's a naturopathic textbook, The Textbook of Natural Medicine, by Murray and Pizzorno. Murray is M-U-R-R-A-Y, and he's been, Dr. Murray has been a guest on Intelligent Medicine, and also Dr. Prezzorno, who's, I think, dean of the
He was the founder of Bastyr University.
He was a founder. He's no longer the dean, but he was the founder of John Bastyr University, which is the premier naturopathic school in the country. And they're brilliant guys, and they've written this, a very encyclopedic book in two volumes. It's like two door stops. So this is a big, big book. I also said to understand that Life Extension is coming out or has come out with a new one. Let me see if I've got it. It's a big, I'm looking at it for it on my computer, LEF.
.org?
Yeah, LEF.org, and I want to see if they have a big book.
That's also actually a very good website for a lot of research.
Good website, good website.
Yeah, Life Extension.
It perhaps is a little promotional at times because they want to encourage people to buy their products.
But
there's a new big book coming out. It's either come out or I'm looking for it from Life Extension, so check it out at lef.org. I don't see it, but we're trying to interview the author of that book, so that'll come out soon. And what's on your favorite list? Because you have a little library there.
Those would be it. I love Dr. Alan Gaby's book. And there are just many other, not a combination of naturopathic and conventional, but I've got my typical, my pathophysiology books, but that's not really answering the question there at all. A lot of the research that we do, at least you and I online, we're looking at PubMed a lot, that kind of thing, but there are lots of books. You want to make sure that you're choosing good.
They have a book called Disease Prevention and Treatment. Which is their, they put out a big book, Life Extension, Disease Prevention and Treatment. So that might be a book that for a layperson. It's very big book, 1,406 pages.
Wow.
And so that, although you're going to get a little bit of Life Extension slant on some of these things, but they're pretty comprehensive. They list a lot of the things that you may want to know about. And I agree with much of what they put out.
Yeah, I like Life Extension as well. You could also subscribe to their magazine.
Right, subscribe to Life Extension.
It's a nice resource as well.
Go to the website. And here's the other thing you can do is listen to my podcast, because I'm doing clinical focus podcasts, and we're going to have a great collection of podcasts. We hope to have it indexed. When we have enough of them there, you'll be able to look up virtually any disease category or health issue, and I'll try to cover them in depth. This week's clinical focus was on the adrenals, and so we're working. We'll eventually do something on thyroid. We'll eventually do something on Parkinson's disease, as we spoke about earlier. We've already done something on Alzheimer's disease. That was one of the first in the clinical focus series, and I'm determined to work through as many of the common syndromes as people will encounter. It's just that we're in the beginning phases of that, and we have only done a few. But look forward to me covering as many of them as possible, and you can also put in your requests. But if you want to, if you want me to do an entire 40 minutes on some rare disease that nobody's ever heard of, like von Schmecklinghausen's syndrome, I'm just making that up, I may not do it. I'll reserve the right to say, I'm sorry, nobody knows what to do about that. And there's only six known sufferers of that condition, so we're not going to do it.
Yeah, but this should be a wonderful resource as you build this. Imagine people could just go listen to one of your podcasts to find out in depth about a disease or a condition. And they could arm themselves with with this knowledge as they go to their own doctors, their own practitioners. That's
right.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so that's something that we're focusing on this summer, and hopefully we'll continue it if the demand is there. Kind of watch our numbers. Currently, we have over 100,000 individual downloads of our podcast per month, which means the people are accessing our podcast and using them. I haven't looked at the latest statistics. These are statistics from earlier this year, but it's building, and we're happy to see that. So any other questions for today's...
We do. Actually, do we have time for
yeah,
our last one?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
This comes from Michael. Dear Layla and Dr. Hoffman, I enjoy and am enlightened much by your podcast and radio program. Thank you. Question. Dr. Alan Pressman says that fish oil capsules should have enteric coating for them to do a person any good. I never heard this before from you, Dr. Hoffman, during his discussion of fish oil. Is Dr. Pressman correct, or is he just using this statement as a marketing gimmick to sell his fish oil? Thank you, Dr. Hoffman, for not turning your Intelligent Medicine radio show into an infomercial.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. I just try to call it as I see it and be objective. And, you know, where there's a product that, that I'm not selling or that is not available via drhoffman.com, and I think it's good, I'll, and I have no vested interest in it. And similarly, if there's something that, we are using that turns out may not be the best quality or there's some aspersion cast on it, I'll be the first one to call it. So as for Dr. Pressman, who is a nutritionally oriented chiropractor, does a radio show, a very knowledgeable guy, I would take some issue with that statement that it's no good to take fish oil that's not enterically coated. We do have enteric coated fish oil, and we use it for two reasons. One is that there's some people who, almost no matter what kind of fish oil capsule they take, they burp. They have this horrible, they really have it's very unpleasant for them to have this fishy repeating on them, fishy odor. And so when something is enteric coated, it opens up lower down in the intestinal tract, and there's less likelihood that it's going to repeat on you. So we use it for that type of patient. Those capsules generally are more expensive, and they, of necessity, since they're coated, they have a little less space inside, so they carry less fish oil. So that's why we would prefer to use the regular fish oil, because it delivers more, is cheaper. I mean, it's not exactly cheap, because we use a really premium fish oil that is more expensive than what you find at discount outlets, Costco and Walmart and so on. But it's more expensive to use the enteric coated, and it's unnecessary. The other thing we use enteric coated for is you use it for ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, because the belief is that if you have an inflammation intestinally, you want the capsule to open up deep within your intestinal tract to do its work there. And that's where those might have an advantage. Some of the research done on ulcerative colitis has been done with enteric coated capsules that seem to work better than the regular capsules.
Yeah.
So that's
all of our questions.
Those are all of our questions. So, all right. So anything to add to today's broadcast?
I'm looking forward to vacation.
So here's the thing. Do you sunscreen?
I use sunscreen on my face.
Right.
I make sure that whenever I'm on the beach, I've always have more than one umbrella, because there's several.
Because your skin is relatively light. It's not like you're not albino or you're not a redhead, but you have relatively light skin. So
I'm relatively light. I use reasonable amounts of sunlight. I make sure not to burn. I get under the umbrella when I need to get under the umbrella. It's that kind of thing. But I use a non-nano, good, organic, made-for-baby stuff on my face.
Great. So let's talk about that for a minute.
Yeah.
This non-nano. We're talking about nanoparticles here.
Yeah.
And there recently was an alert from, I think, Consumer Reports about using these spray-on sunscreens. That number one, when you spray, if it's got chemicals in it, you're going to inhale the chemicals. That's not good.
Yeah.
And number two, with a spray on, if it's got what are called nanoparticles, you can explain to people what nanoparticles are.
They are not microparticles, which is what it used to be, but nanoparticles are, being so small, they can get into places, organs, places that it shouldn't go, especially as we inhale them. As a matter of fact, Dr. Hoffman, I think the FDA has issued some kind of a statement recently saying, don't spray that stuff upwind of children or something like that.
Yeah, Consumer Reports also, I think, issued an alert on that. And so, the two main sunscreens that I actually like to use, but not in a spray form, I like to use them topically, are things that contain either zinc oxide or titanium dioxide. Now, zinc oxide is the thing that, those muscular surfer dude lifeguards used to wear when we were kids. They used to have like a stripe down their nose, and that's with zinc oxide. And zinc oxide, unfortunately, makes you look pasty-faced. But it's actually a sun reflector, and it's a primitive form of sunscreen, but it really works well. And the old zinc oxide just contained ground up zinc oxide, not nanoparticles. It had a sort of a pasty look to it, but it really reflected and protected. Now they're using smaller particles. From what I'm hearing, the particles are not so small that they will actually go through the pores and into the systemic circulation from the skin. They say that that's not possible. But also titanium dioxide, which is an ingredient in white paint, is used in a lot of these products. And they are to be smeared on, but not close to the mouth because you don't want to consume them orally and you don't want to spray them on. So I'm with you on using zinc oxide or even titanium cream that contains titanium dioxide, minimum of chemicals, because the chemicals may actually, with another issue is these SPF 50s, they're no good because they give you this false sense of security. You can spend the whole day in the sun, but they actually don't efficiently block the UVA, and you may not get a burn, but you may actually get solar damage. So they're even the FDA is cautioning against SPF 50s that claim that you can spend, 50 times as much time in the sun with an SPF 50 because the burn time is 50 times longer. That's a bogus claim.
Yeah. That and I wear a hat.
There you go.
Yeah.
And your skin is, you really don't have a lot of solar damage on your skin. It looks like you protected your skin, so that's a good thing.
I hope so.
Right.
I hope so.
So very good. Okay, so enjoy fun in the sun, and we will keep broadcasting podcasts throughout. But for you in particular, you'll be off. All right.
Yeah.
Very good. Thanks for joining us, folks. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and you're listening to this week's Q&A with Layla. This is Intelligent Medicine.